Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Tom Scholt, and I co-host the channel with Kevin Lindsay. On this episode, we speak with Raghav Rajagopalan about his book, Immersive Systemic Knowing, Advancing Systems Thinking Beyond Rational Analysis, out from Springer in 2020. This fascinating book advances systems thinking by introducing a new philosophy of systemic knowing. It argues that there are inescapable limits to rational understanding. Humankind has always depended on extended ways of knowing to complement the rational analytic approach. The book establishes that the application of such methods is fundamental to systemic practice. And the author advocates embracing two modes of consciousness: intentionality, which Western philosophy has long recognized, and non-intentional awareness, which Eastern philosophy additionally highlights. The simultaneity of these two modes of consciousness and the variety of knowings they spawn are harnessed for a more holistic, systemic knowing. So without any further ado, let's jump right in to my conversation with Raghav Rajagopalan. Raghav Rajagopalan, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you now across a great distance. Thank you for joining us all the way from India. It's a real pleasure to have you here on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure, really. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So I guess we'll start with our traditional question, which is to tell us a little bit about what brought you to an engagement with the world of systems.
In terms of systems scholarship, I am an accidental entrant in a way. So I'll come to how that happened a bit later. The reason I say that up first is I think that the point is that I have not had the benefit of scholarship training in the manner that a graduate degree or a post-graduation in the West would provide. So in a sense, I believe that has contributed positively. I'm free of the conventions of academic thinking and writing. And that has allowed me to, in a way, roam free and even speak heresy. And I regard that as a strength and contribution of my book. So there's also a, most delicious irony in the entire creation that is my book, because it's an elaborate theoretical argument for valuing practical knowledge or practical knowing, as I like to call it. So that's about my entrance into system scholarship. But what happened was that almost 2 decades ago, I encountered Peter Senge, the fifth discipline. And ever since then, that has added a flavor to the way I think and look at things and, deal with my consulting practice. So that has informed me. And I think that has gone side by side with a certain kind of holistic, systemic mindset or attitude that in very many ways and forms permeates you if you, from an Eastern Indian kind of culture. So those things have been there for long. So if I were to track back, you see, it's curious. I was raised in this enclave of atomic scientists at a nuclear plant, which is 100 miles from civilization. In fact, interestingly, that plant was Canadian designed and built.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. That gave me a phenomenal kind of focus on two things and an oversupply of abundance of these two things. One was science and the other was nature. So the entire population of this enclave kind of worshipped scientific temper. you know, no adult would ever talk to a child about anything else. And outside the fence of our little community was bountiful miles of countryside, you know, grassland, mango orchards, forest, mountain, and streams to explore. So I was always studying biology in the real, conducting experiments in physics and chemistry. So that you know, that was the genesis. Then I graduated in chemistry. I was drawn to the novelty of a new postgraduate course on rural management. And there began a series of very profound encounters which influenced my life thereon. You see, in India, the poverty-stricken kind of rural areas are a completely different world from the scientists' enclaves. As I began to work with, you know, rural communities, tribal folk, fisher folk, rural artisans, I had to completely unlearn a whole universe of things. And I slowly learned that their form of wisdom is equally profound, you know, in our learned world, although it cannot be expressed in English or in scientific terms. So from that point onwards, it is, you know, my intellectual journey has been about this question of getting to the bottom of this oxymoron term, you know, rural management. So then my career was about, you know, a decade in rural development practice and a subsequent decade in corporate organizational development and learning. And then I kind of settled down into my own little practice in organizational development. Most of my clients were essentially small NGOs, non-government organizations, charities, and a few corporate clients thrown in. But what I was always doing was looking at culture and collective psychology, you know, hidden structures that shape the dynamics of people systems. Now, it just happened that around 2010 or thereabouts, I attended a wedding in London and got to have a telephone conversation with Jennifer Wilby, who headed the Center for System Studies at the University of Hull in the UK. It was vacation time, so all we could do was a telephonic conversation. She kind of casually remarked during that conversation that with my deep understanding of systems, it would be a breeze for me to obtain a PhD. But that idea somehow stuck with me, and I went in and transacted that PhD at Hull from 2012 to 2015. And so my book is essentially, you know, what came out of that doctoral study. So that's kind of the genesis of the book.
Excellent.
Background. Yeah.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. And was Gerald Midgley your supervisor as well?
That's right. Gerald Midgley was my supervisor. And it's interesting. You know, when I went into the doctoral program, I was in a sense in my midlife crisis. On the face of it, I had been a rolling stone. Mm. My career did not add up in an impressive way. You know, I traversed multifarious universes. I was in rural development at one point and corporate organizational learning at another point, and so on. And so I had this feeling that I needed to bring together my life's work forcefully. I had been exercising great care and restraint throughout my working life, not recklessly doing things, you know, not greatly sort of informed by the need to build an impressive career profile, but painstakingly assembling my understanding, you know, of fundamental foundational questions, you know, like the oxymoron of rural management, by repeatedly throwing myself into new contexts and adventures. I was living life on the edge, on the edge all along. And so there was an intimation somehow when I took this plunge into this new adventure of the PhD that there would be something great coming out of this new reckless adventure. I had constantly found myself caught between two schizophrenically disconnected worlds here in my country. I mean, we call them India and Bharat. So the educated urban population is India, but we have this great rural mass, which is not so much anymore now, but looking back two decades ago, or rather totally disconnected from this India. And so we call it Bharat, which is the Hindi, the local name, you know, for our country. And it seemed to me that to represent Bharat to India, I had to take the circuitous route of going to the West, since India is totally besotted by the West. So I started off with Gerald Midgley's 2000 book and then his 4-volume series. And, you know, the gap kind of intuitively hit me. It's one of those inexplicable things. You have been informed by 3 or 4 decades of experience, and then you're looking at this new universe of theory, and then, you're trying to grapple with it. And as you're writing, that writing takes a life of its own, and, you know, something comes out of it. So that's how I try to get to the root of the problem. And that's how the sudden insight about striving and abiding, and then, you know, the 4 ways of knowing that was very, very, very remarkably, it was deeply, it spoke to me, it touched a very deep chord in me, the 4 ways of knowing framework. So willingly, I became a systems philosopher.
Yes, thank you. Well, it's
to understand and explicate my own practice.
Right. Yeah. I think that's not as uncommon as it might seem for a lot of folks that find the engagement with the systems literature in the field after a substantial amount of practice. I think it's a real testament. So folks, I think would benefit by knowing something about Gerald's 2000 book, Systemic Intervention, because your book engages so much with it. But it's also, I think, a real testament to the relationship you must have had with Gerald, that you could spend so much of your focus in a critique of your supervisor's work, in a very respectful critique, but nonetheless, I mean, you identified gaps in the systems world, and focus to a large degree on the work of your supervisor. So it speaks to a real healthy, to me, kind of intellectual. And deeper than intellectual, spiritual generosity between supervisor and supervisee. That because he's, you know, I first found out about your book because of conversations with Gerald, who said to me, knowing my own work, he said, "You must read this book. You need to talk to Raghav." So it's a testament to Gerald's spirit as well that that he would be so welcoming of your new mode of thinking about what's missing from the work of systems practitioners, including himself. So I just wanted to note that. So you've mentioned a gap that came to strike you. So let's talk a little bit about what prompted you down this path. You've already spoken about, you know, the deep wisdom you found in these rural communities outside of the Western scientific rationalism, the deep value that they hold, and your desire to bring those sort of into the fold in a way that could fill those missing gaps in systems thinking. So maybe we could sort of hit a number of topics with this question in terms of, you know, why this book now, and kind of an overview of what you mean by this term you've coined that is the title of the book, Immersive Systemic Knowing.
Oh, wow. That's very many questions rolled into one. But
I'll break it into...
I'll take them...
break it into whatever portions you wish.
Yeah. So first the question about my relationship with Gerald. I must say that, look, I mean, there is not too much to speak about me and my spirit. I've always been a renegade and a rebel, and I haven't... sort of gone by any conventional notions of how to be and what to do, how to act in the world. So I've always been my own sort of tune master, you know, calling my own tune. But with Gerald, I must say that, very quickly, right from the beginning, we hit it off in several ways, and most particularly, what came to me right from the beginning was the tremendous amount of both personal and intellectual integrity that this man had, you know, which is why I could actually sort of write up a chapter which critiqued his work and send it across to him. And his very first reaction, you know, when we met after I critiqued his book, Systemic Intervention, his 2000 book, was to say that, Raghav, you know, you've done something amazing. I mean, this is brilliant. I am absolutely floored by this. In 20 years, nobody has ever critiqued my work, and this is the first. So, you know, so that speaks to the spirit of, Gerald. And he's been one of the most outspoken kind of supporters of my work. So, you know, he's been going around telling a lot of people that they should acquaint themselves with my book and with my work. So, yes, I mean, I think that to me, you know, like anybody else, he's complex. He has a lot of sides to him. There are many things, but then the level of personal integrity and intellectual integrity is quite remarkable. So that's about Gerald, mm-hmm. about his book. What was very interesting was that it covered a whole canvas, you know, from theory to methods to practice, and recast a lot of what, you know, that group of people out there at Hull over 2-3 decades have been grappling with, the whole idea of the critical systems approach. You know, it had gone to the depths of that view or that perspective, and it had he's very articulate in his writing, so there's a lot of lucidity in his writing. So it's a very eminently readable book which covers a very wide canvas. So that was wonderful. But you know, to me, it's just where I came from and my formative experiences and my background as an Indian and everything very automatically surfaced this gap that I found there, which, you know, as I have stated in my book and everywhere, that you know, critiquing systemic intervention is just an example to show that all of current Western contemporary systems thinking suffers from this same kind of deficit, an epistemic deficit. So in a sense, that brings me maybe perhaps to, you know, this book and its content and the titling of it as Immersive Systemic Knowing. So, you know, at one level, you know, it's a three word kind of label. And so you can juxtapose it against critical systems thinking. So, you know, where one approach is critical, and which means rational thinking, logical, analytical thinking. Excuse me. I am saying immersive. And where you are saying systems, I am saying systemic. And where you're saying thinking, I'm talking about knowing. So, you know, in a sense, the idea is to contrast, you know, the universe of ideas from which, of the perspective from which that approach is drawn with the universe of concepts and perspectives from which I have built my approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And so you begin the book with a really thorough survey of the movements of systems thinking and systems science practice, a number of interchangeable and overlapping terms to go through, you know, from the hard systems beginnings to the more interpretivist interventions into the soft systems of Checkland and other more interpretivist subjective kind of approaches, and into the critical phase. And you seem to be ushering us into a fourth phase, which you pointed out that the critical, you know, there's been much gained by the critical turn, but that it's still within this envelope of a kind of slavish connection to rationality, and that there are other types of insights and of course, a kind of systemic knowing that can be approached through other means from outside of this Western obsession with the rational. And you introduce the idea of two modes of consciousness, which seem to be sort of at the bedrock of the philosophy you're putting forward. Becoming striving, which is very much the sort of modus operandi of Western rationality, and then another mode that you call being abiding. Can you tell us a little bit about those two concepts and how you came to this this description of them?
Yes, I think in many ways that's the touchstone, the kernel, the key core sort of takeaway from my book. Although there are very many ideas in my book, but I would put this as the fulcrum, you know, of the pivot around which the entire argument is being turned around. You see, coming from the East and coming from India and coming from this fact that, you know, I was schooled in a very, standard Western scientific kind of worldview, as it were. But then I went into this rural development work, and then I had to go through deep deschooling. So it's all of this that has informed this understanding. But what I'm talking about is very simple. And so I've pointed out this example in my book, and, you know, we can draw on multiple kind of experiences that all of us have, which is that, you know, so if you look at the foundational assumption in the Western philosophy is to say that consciousness, you know, how we acquire knowledge or knowing, arises from what's called intentionality. So the mind reaches out to the external world or to the, you know, whatever reality around us with a certain direction, with a certain purposiveness. There is an intentionality, and it is based on that whatever is picked up, you know, through our sense organs or whatever is interpreted. Now, sure, I mean, most of us go through our lives with a lot of direction and purpose in our everyday activities. But in all of our lives, there are also moments, there are also, situations where we can very comfortably, calmly be with no purpose. I mean, I may be relaxing at the end of the day, listening to my favorite piece of music, whether it's some classical Beethoven or Mozart, or whether it's rock or hip hop or whatever it is. Or I might, you know, be spending a moment with my life partner, or I might simply be, you know, enchanted by, the view of a sunrise or a sunset at the beach or on a holiday. And at those moments, I'm not necessarily bringing any purpose from my mind into the world. And yet I am not asleep. I'm not, passive. I mean, there is alertness, there is awakeness, there is all of that. And yet no directing myself. Now, this is what I have called the other mode of consciousness, the being abiding mode. And of course, there is a lot of, effort, especially directed towards, you know, people in the West who have built up stress and who want to relieve themselves of stress, trying to learn meditation and, you know, centering and relaxation and what have you. And they see that as the only sort of reason to be without purpose, without intentionality, apparently. But if you actually look at it, I mean, this mode is also almost always operating. It's always available. It's latent. And in fact, I believe both modes can operate at the same time simultaneously. And I see this in a lot of people, that at one level, the both modes are switched on, operating all the time. So if you see a very good practitioner of any craft, you know, I mean, it may be a systems interventionist, it may be a surgeon, it may be a musician, it may be a theater actor. If you think about it a little, you will realize that, yes, these people, what they bring to their craft with their passion and dedication is this ability to be both informed by a purpose and yet at the same time to be sort of restrained and very open to the entire experience, to the experience of the moment, and not sort of very narrowly focused and driven only by that purpose. So both modes do operate and can operate. And so that's the argument I'm bringing up.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that this, in cultivating the being abiding part of our consciousness, is what can give us some kind of access to what you're calling the deep intelligence field. So can you say a little bit about the deep intelligence field and its teleonomic movement towards a kind of wellness and a kind of balance?
That's a difficult area. It's exploratory kind of territory in a sense, but I believe in this very deeply because of a whole series of experiences I have had, life experiences, and it can't be explained by anything else. I'm quite sure that a lot of people have perhaps had similar experiences and possibly not interpreted it in this fashion. If you really look at what are the sources of knowing, how do we really get to know something that's completely new, that's something that we've not known before? Very often, we cannot have a logical explanation for how it has come about. I mean, there are a lot of philosophers of science who have talked about the fact that, science is a preparatory sort of process. All your careful setting up of experiments and, defining of things and laying out the territory and the boundaries of what you're exploring, it's simply preparation to receive an insight. But how that insight comes about and where it comes from is a mystery. Now, I have experienced, this sort of mysterious access to knowledge, to knowing of various sorts in multiple contexts, but especially over the last two decades, it has been very routine in work that I have been doing in organizational culture and development. So, I belong to this, we have an academy of organizational development practice in India called the Sumedhas Academy. And I am a fellow of the Sumedhas, which means that I've gone through a certain process to be qualified to apply this Sumedhian methodology. And this methodology is something that began, about three decades ago as an offshoot of, the group inquiry processes that originated in the West. But it soon developed a character of its own, which is very Indian. And which means that essentially, if you just want to look at the very sort of basic differences, we are not aggressive, we are not interventionist. It's a very it's a space where the exploration is facilitated only by invitation, and so on. But more than that, what we have done is we moved on from rational inquiry into the processes. What am I thinking? How am I feeling? Are you thinking the same way? This is how I think about what I feel. All of this, getting into cobwebs and knots, we have eschewed that altogether, and we use modalities like theater and yoga and yogic sleep, you know, yoga nidra, and a whole lot of other nonverbal modalities to deepen this inquiry into the self and into the collective. And it works phenomenally well. And in that space, I have in particular tended to use a lot of theater and meditation techniques. And routinely, in working with theater techniques, which are essentially actor preparation techniques that we deploy into this group inquiry space, magic happens. You know, people come to know about things which there is absolutely no explanation for. I've given several examples in the chapter on methodology in my book, but I could just repeat one or two of them here to illustrate what I mean. Which is, for example, you have been, you know, taking a set of people through their paces in terms of sort of learning some, doing some theater exercises as part of a group inquiry workshop or something. And you suddenly announce a new activity or exercise to them, which they have no clue about previously. So there's a bunch of 30 people in a large room, and you ask them to march about randomly and suddenly freeze wherever they are. So you have 30 people standing at random locations, looking in random directions, and then you give them a brief, which is that this group has to count from 1 to 30 because there are 30 of them. And there are rules about this. So anybody can kick it off by saying the number 1. The next person to call off the number 2 must do it within 3 seconds. If you know anybody in the group fails to call out the next successive number in the sequence within 3 seconds, the you know, game is off and you have to roll back to the start. And the other rule is that if it just happens that there are 2 or 3 people who call out a number simultaneously, once again, the game is off and, you know, you have to roll back to the beginning. Now, in reasonably serious groups, which are, you know, working with this entire workshop activity with some sincerity, routinely you find that after 3 or 4 failed efforts, on the 4th round or the 5th round, the group is actually able to count out from 1 to 30 without a mistake. And this is random because nobody knows what number they are going to call out. It's not been planned. It's not known activity. And people just have to attune themselves to the rest of the group, and something in their head tells them that this is my moment to call out, and they call out, and it works from 1 to 30. And there are groups which have been so astonished by this that they've said, can we do it again? Can we have another go at it? And they do it, and sure enough, it works again. And it's an entirely random different set of people who have you know, called out the numbers in a completely different sequence. So, I mean, this is just one example, but I mean, routinely in hundreds of spaces, in hundreds of places, I have come across experiences where people get information, access to information, which there is no rational, logical explanation to. And there's a lot of exploration of this in my book. There are a lot of examples from a lot of fields. And so this is what I call the deep intelligence field. And, you know, essentially somewhere in this book, I think I have sort of reproduced a statement from Stanislav Grof, roughly to the effect that, you know, if in a sense, if you you know, that if you suspend your sort of becoming striving sort of approach mode, and you can actually just be attentive to the universe around you, then you know, you pick up this kind of information. So I wish I could use
it's wonderful
exact
that
words, but yeah, that quote is there in the book somewhere. So
Yeah. It's really fantastic. And, you know, one of the reasons that Gerald Midgley told me I must read your book is because my own practice is involving using applied theater as a tool that up until the reading of your book, I would say I've been describing my use of form theater as a tool for a kind of systemic analysis. And I'm now understanding it as a result of the framework you've provided in your book for understanding it actually as a kind as more as a form of systemic knowing. And, you know, that, you know, why would we bother using the theater rather than just, you know, talking about the systemic connection? In my case, we look at workplace conflict because the experiential dimension of being in an interaction is full of all kinds of other information. And then the experience of the people watching it and the connections they make. So you've really created a framework, certainly for someone like myself, as I now start to think of my own work as about systemic knowing rather than just systemic analysis or systemic understanding is really, really powerful. And of course, there's meditation practices. There's a whole tradition, many traditions of a kind of holistic and interconnected web inside various practices that you're drawing on, Indian practices. And also there's some discussion of course, altered states of consciousness that Groff examined, including, you know, experiments with LSD and psilocybin. You know, there are those moments of sudden insight that come, and of course that research was abandoned for many years because of a legal sort of crackdown, but is now back in a big way because the kinds of massive therapeutic leaps forward that are made possible by either practices or substances or some ancient combination thereof that opens up people to this being abiding place is really quite profound. And living here on the west coast of Canada, I won't go into too much detail, but I can just tell you through my own personal experience,
right?
I know this to be true in terms of combinations of substances and practices.
Yeah, there are so many
articles
that come up every day on this topic. Yeah, so I'm in a sense dimly aware that there's a lot of exploration around this and around, you know, things like microdosing and yeah, whole lot of things. Yes. See, the crux of the matter is this, you know, that if I am grappling with my behavior, now the behavior is something that comes from a deeper sort of level inside me. You know, so I might rationally be aware that there is something inadequate about my response or that there is some form of behavior that's not productive enough that I wish to change or so on. But that rational knowing does not necessarily translate into a change. You know, the moment you're using theta, so of course there are different levels and modalities of using theta, and I don't go so much into something of the sort of role play. But if you were just to consider, you know, if somebody were, if there was some sort of a role play going on, and if, you know, somebody were trying to deal with a certain situation and enact how they would deal with it. Now, what happens is that what is being enacted, whether it's authentic or not, is something that is absolutely, you know, with no uncertainty about it, available information to everybody who's present in that space. And it is that that touching of that authentic, you know, connection with oneself, that sort of alignment internally, triggers off the immediate potential for a transformation or a change, you know. So this is sort of akin to what I have seen in, because I have dabbled in psychotherapy practice. I have had some friends who are psychiatrists and psychotherapists, and I have sort of worked alongside them and so on. And you know, Carl Rogers speaks about this. So he says that the only requirement for psychotherapy is to be completely empty within yourself and completely receptive of the other person's, entirety of being. And if you can simply receive the entirety of the other person with no judgment, with no other reverberation inside you, then that person is just healed of that entrapment of whatever she or he is facing. And they, they can just transform themselves. The only requirement for healing is this. The psychotherapist actually doesn't have to do any intervention of, counseling and speaking and explaining and, exhorting or anything of that sort. This is what Carl Rogers had said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the kind of transformative wonderful.
And
power.
I think an important... sorry to interrupt, but one of the things I want to draw our listeners' attention to, and please correct me if I misstate this in some way, but someone might be asking, okay, well, that's great. We know about mindfulness, we know about meditation, we know about mental health. What's this got to do with systems practice? And for me, a lot of the answer to that in your book lies in the notion that this deep intelligence field tends towards balance, that it's a field of interconnectedness. And that it tends towards balance and health. And one of the most powerful things you said, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but to me, one of the most powerful things that you say in the book is that when one has those kinds of breakthroughs, it is a systemic knowing, because one becomes aware not just of how is what I'm thinking, doing, experiencing impact me, but how does it impact the systems in which I am a part, which is a very different kind of awakening and awareness than simply, oh, here's what I need to do for my own goals and my own striving. But I'm now aware of myself in this field of interconnectedness and then I'm receiving an insight that makes me even more aware of all the systems in which I'm connected and how I can move towards a kind of balance with those, the more than human world, et cetera, non-human sentience, all of that kind of thing. Am I phrasing that in a way that you would agree with?
Yes, I think you have got that quite correctly. But if I might just kind of explain this from a concept that, people from the West have started picking up, but I don't know how clearly it has been explained and accessed by everybody. So we have this concept of dharma, in the Indian philosophy. And, in Sumedas, we will work with that idea of dharma. Now, what does dharma say? So there are a couple of things that dharma says about this. So for the first is that, from a systems perspective, one of the things that you mentioned in your paraphrasing was that we are parts of many systems, that are nested systems. So I am for myself, but I'm also part of a family, and then I'm part of a community, of a neighborhood, and I'm part of a work system, and I'm part of the, neighborhood or city or town that I live in, and so on and so forth. And I have a variety of... sort of my membership in all these multiple nested systems enjoins me to, have a certain responsibility towards all of these. And now the interesting thing is that the idea of dharma is that there are a couple of things it says. One is that it says that we can know enough about, let me put it this way. See, Western thinking would readily admit that there are some things we do not know. Now, it's less ready to accept that there are some things that we cannot know. But however, in the Eastern sort of thinking, this is quite commonplace. But the idea of dharma tells us that we can know enough about these mysterious dimensions in a certain, let's say, black box way, in a certain outside way, to decisively act from. So that's one paradox. Now, the other sort of key paradox is that dharma also tells us when to withhold from acting or interfering and when to trust the unfolding emerging process. So it's, maybe that's not paradoxical perhaps, but it's antithetical to the Western approach. So what dharma says is that inherently there can be conflict between my requirements or responsibilities towards these multiple levels, but that an attunement to the being abiding mode would in a sense creatively resolve that conflict. And so if I approach it with that kind of a mindset, then the conflict would kind of be made to disappear, or the choice would be clear. And in a sense, the dharmic principle is that the choice is always to be in terms of the larger whole, the larger universe of life. So it's not the individual unit that's most important, but the larger life sphere, if there is a conflict between any two levels. And that's a very fundamental dharmic principle that's constantly repeated in all the mythology and legends and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I do, without taking us down back down the rabbit hole of too much rationality, though, I do want to draw us to, and there's so much in this book, it's so rich, and we won't have time to cover all of it, but I do want to take us back to some of the other systems thinkers, though, whose work you have drawn in, or some other methods and ways of thinking that have created a bridge, it seems to me, between the becoming striving that a lot of systems work has maybe still been trapped within, and these more holistic and reflective practices from India. And there's a couple of things you draw in. One of the things you draw on quite a bit, in quite extensively, developed by Hodgson, who's been on this podcast before, so it's one of the reasons I want to touch on it, is the anticipatory present moment. Can you say a little bit about how you've worked with Hodgson's anticipatory present moment, which, of course, he's developed back from Rosen, how that's played a role in the evolution of your thinking?
The thing is that I was looking at some of these systems principles that are repeated ad nauseum, holism, inactive cognition. There is this curious gap that, at the ideas level, systems thinkers, espouse all these grand ideas. But then when it comes down to actual methodology and practice and technique, there is no bridge between those kind of ideas. And so what do you mean by inactive cognition in your practice as a systems practitioner, as a systems interventionist? So I was looking for frameworks which would allow me to sort of build bridges between, principles. And so that's why I used Malhotra's sort of four lenses idea to unpack holism, and also, Hodgson's idea there of the strong second order processes of observation. When I was looking at, unpacking inactive cognition and making it sort of accessible in some fashion, this is when the anticipatory present moment kind of offered itself to me as something that might bridge this gap. And so that's the idea that, if both these modes of consciousness are operating in our mind, it also means that we are not necessarily only, behaving like, in the moment of cognition and action, it's not simply, referencing memory for past experiences, past stored knowledge, and then, applying that mechanically to the best choice or decision of action in the moment. But it's also the anticipatory side, the side that draws on things that apparently we do not know, or that we might not immediately link with. And so, Hodgson's idea, especially of the three modalities of time which operate simultaneously, you know, so there is the sort of linear clockwork time that we operate with, but there is also this timeless dimension of knowing that sits with all of us all along, which sort of coincides with the being abiding mode. And there is also this timely dimension, which tells you at what point to act or to plunge or to, you know, take the action. So I found all of these, it's an extremely rich conceptual map. It takes a lot of explaining, but I found that it had all these elements in it which were very enriching, but which sort of unpacked the idea of an active cognition in the moment for somebody to look at conceptually.
Mm-hmm. And anything you want to say about, you mentioned the four ways of knowing that you bring in to work from Malhotra and also the praxis learning cycle. Anything you want to say about those frameworks and how they've, the role they've played in this kind of amazing bridge building that you've done, which I think is a really quite a remarkable achievement of the book for those of us still fairly strongly addicted to rationality, you take us there in a gentle way and in a way that you build these bridges in such a beautiful way. Is there anything else you want to say about those particular practices, the four ways of knowing and the praxis learning cycle?
You're putting in me in a little bit of difficulty because the problem, whether it's the anticipatory present moment or the praxis learning cycle or the four ways of knowing, each one of them is worthy of a book. I mean, and they are, some of them are written through such large pieces of, so they are very large pieces of conceptual knowledge and with many elements, very rich dimensions to them. But I wouldn't know how to sort of explain that in a couple of sentences. But then, that's precisely the the role that they have played for me is because otherwise, this whole idea of being abiding or the whole idea of the other modes of consciousness, other ways of knowing, deeper ways of knowing, what is called tacit knowing, all of that, there's always this Oriental Occidental kind of a gap that exists between these two worlds, you know. So that's all voodoo and that's all mumbo jumbo, and rationality is what makes sense because that is what you can dialogue about and have discourse and . But the fact is that if you look at a lot of rich knowledge systems, I mean, if you looked at medicinal system called Ayurveda, which because I have gone into that a little bit. I don't know if at all there is any awareness of Ayurveda in Canada. It's very
absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, it's varied across the world, but if you look at some of these rich knowledge systems, then the point is that if you go down to the fundamental principles of science, and so if you talk about verifiability, if you talk about repeatability, then many of them actually pass muster, but they sort of fathom more deeper principles about the biochemistry or whatever domain they're working with, as compared to some of the conventional scientific inquiry. So this whole question of, what is science, what is rationality, those questions I have tried to examine very deeply, and I have drawn on some of these models to assist that inquiry.
Mm-hmm. Great. And there's others as well. I mean, there's a wonderful use of Bill Torbert's inquiry. Sorry,
action inquiry.
The name is escaping me at the moment.
Action inquiry.
Action inquiry. Yes, action inquiry. Yeah. So pulling on these traditions that seem to, that seem to dare to get right up to the doorstep of the kind of things you're talking about, but still seem to be shackled to needing to explain them in ways that would satisfy the Western rational mind. And so you sort of, you do this wonderful job of taking us to that threshold through those Western practices that have dared to sort of intimate the kinds of things you're talking about. And then you take us right across the threshold into these with less concern as to whether or not they quote unquote pass muster in that way. Are there any other of the traditions that you've wanted to bring our attention to and to bring into our ways of knowing? You've mentioned Sumedra and some yoga and some Ayurveda. Is there any of the other traditions or things that you want to bring our attention to as we move to a close in the interview?
Not in a specific way. I mean, I've just named these three because I have a certain experience of these. But if you look at indigenous knowledge systems across the world, and so I have, you know, I've quoted from Malidoma Somi, I've quoted from a whole lot of people. So indigenous knowledge systems across the world, a lot of them have very in very deep and sophisticated ways. Worked with this. And then there are authors like David Abram and Amitav Ghosh who have actually done this bridge building in terms of, you know, moving between these two types of knowledge systems, the modern rational sensibility and the, indigenous sensibilities extremely well. So there are traditions all over the world, and there are lots of people working with a lot of these things. There are numerous sort of networks of people now. Just yesterday I was reading about, I forget the exact name of that, precise name of that network, but this, I think they are sort of based in Canada or something, but working with indigenous communities to heal the trauma in the indigenous communities, mixing both, modern understanding, modern ideas about trauma healing with indigenous rituals and practices. So I don't think that one has to look to specific techniques. It's more the principle that, you know, what do we draw from these other epistemologies, and, how do we carefully sort of titrate and triangulate between multiple epistemologies in whatever we are doing.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, what's going on here in Canada too, is that there is, a long overdue increasing recognition of the powerful, powerful ways of knowing of the First Nations of the territory that I'm privileged to be tolerated as an uninvited guest on. and the efforts need to increase and to continue, but to open up to these multiple ways of knowing is definitely a big part of, efforts towards reconciliation and right relations with our Indigenous people. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because there is such deep value in wrestling with the wicked problems that the Western rational mind has helped create and seems to be at an absolute loss to be able to solve, so, or to at least tame. So we'll move into our final question, which is, what are you working on now? What's next for you? Are you going to continue in this somewhat scholarly vein, or has this been a sort of a detour and then back just deep into the world of practice, or what are your plans moving forward?
No, actually what has happened is that it's been a difficult re-entry into the world after my doctoral study and scholarship work there. Because I found absolutely no takers for what I had assembled back in India, and that was a very deep disappointment. But I also got caught up with a whole lot of other life cycle issues and things. So some of my work had to sit on the back burner. I have dropped my consulting practice. It was difficult to go back into that. I had also changed location in India, and there were life cycle issues. Well, we have elder care for three people, between me and my wife at home now, and things like that. But what has happened is that, and I found it difficult to continue my scholarly work in the circumstances in which I find myself. But what has been sort of informing me, and I put together a little framework where I have a diagram, but it needs to be written up about, is that I've looked at this understanding of levels of mind, you know. So, you know, I found it in Groff, and then I found that, you know, it's a refrain amongst many, 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 many people. So there's this psychotherapist in the US called Francis Weller, and he talks about something called the five gates of grief. And he's working with healing communities, you know, healing people in healing communities wherever he goes. And then I find this refrain in the Indian Samkhya philosophy. That's the underlying epistemological model that informs yoga. And I find this refrain in very many places, that there are basically something like five levels of mind. And I'm just working on putting that model together right now.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to, greatly look forward to whatever is next for you. I hope that, I know that those who continue to encounter you in your work will benefit greatly. And I'm hoping you'll still find some time to assist us in the West and everywhere else to continue to access these other ways of knowing that can only continue to enrich our systems practice through this kind of immersive systemic knowing. So thank you very much for joining us. And I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was really stimulating and lovely conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, podcast channel on the New Books Network, where we've been talking to Raghav Rajagopalan about his book, Immersive Systemic Knowing.